Now back to Rintoul and Sermon.
I never joined. So this is a genuine interest question, not anything else. Are you on Facebook?
Yes.
Okay. So I've never done Facebook. I've never done Facebook.
Okay.
And if I call it the Facebook, does that make me an OG because that was the original name? Or does that make me old because it's called Facebook for most people?
I think it's going to call and make you just a little old there, Scotty. It's
okay.
Facebook. Same as when people say the Twitter. The Twitter. Yeah, it's I've been on Facebook. I don't use it as much as I used to. I find it's best used for getting recipes. That's why I use Facebook these days, which is pretty good.
Pinterest, apparently really good for recipes as well.
Yeah, I've never been a Pinterest person because it's too complicated for me, I find. Now, I haven't just explored it enough. Maybe that makes me a little simple-minded if Pinterest is a little complicated for me. But I've heard that. But yeah, that's my Facebook. That's what I use it for now.
So why the hell are you asking about Facebook Rintoul? Well, here's why. Because I don't know if this still exists, but even though I've never been on Facebook, never been a member, I do know that they had that relationship status thing on there. And there was one box you could check at one point. Maybe this still exists. Maybe it doesn't. You'll have to tell me where you would check. It's complicated.
Yep. I don't think they have that anymore. I don't. I'd have to go look at my Facebook. I don't think. Hopefully I don't have it checked. It's complicated when it comes to mine at the moment because it's not. But it used to be you could do single, married, divorced, in a relationship, or it's complicated.
Right. So here's why I bring it up.
Okay.
Milan Lucic and his status with Vancouver in particular, but I think this has been true with Calgary over the years as well. It's complicated. If you look at the relationship of the fan bases in their two respective cities and what they feel about Milan Lucic, and I want people to text in on this, 960-960,
yeah.
650-650. Right now, it's pretty easy to see why Flames fans like Milan Lucic, because they are long past the cap hit. They are more about expectations jiving with what's been delivered. And Milan Lucic is one of the very few Calgary Flames who's over-delivered on expectation this year. That doesn't mean he's not a flawed player. He still turns the puck over and has at times in their own zone this year. But he has given that team more than he was expected to this year. And you can't say that about very many members of the Calgary Flames.
Yeah, when you look back on this season for the Calgary Flames, Scott, a lot of players are a little introspective about how their seasons went. I think Milan Lucic can look back on this season and say, yeah, I'm going to hold my head high. I played well, you know, I mean, like you said, he's still got some flaws, but he's fit himself into a role as that third line player. And I think that's exactly where Milan Lucic should be at this point in his career. I think also for Calgary Flames fans, Scott, it's like, it's a little bit of, you know, you look at Milan Lucic and the contract, but also you got rid of a player in James Neal, who of course had probably fallen out of favor with the fan base as well. But then Lucic last year, I mean, maybe a little bit higher expectations because of that, you know, $7 million price tag. But I think this year, I think he likes where he is in his life, Scott. I think he likes where he is with, well, he liked Jeff Ward for sure, and I think he actually likes playing under Daryl Sutter as well. So I think he's very calm and just at peace with the role that he's playing right now, and that's translating onto the ice.
So I'm glad you brought up the Edmonton aspect of this, because I imagine when the trade went down, there were a lot of Flames fans who went, oh, really? Like, I've spent the past few years not liking this guy, and now you're bringing him to Calgary like he was an Oiler and he was an in-your-face type player. How's this going to work? I imagine Lucic himself wondered about that. In fact, he spoke to that when he obviously accepted the trade to Calgary. The question was asked at the time, well, who won the trade? Well, in the first 2 months of the trade, the real deal, James Neal, won the deal. How about now?
Yep.
Who won the trade now?
Oh, I think it's absolutely the Calgary Flames. One, you get a conditional third-round pick with it because of what happened last year in the deal with Edmonton, I guess, quote-unquote, making the playoffs and Neal almost getting 20 goals. I think when you look at the fact that what James Neal has done or lack thereof this season, he's been healthy scratched. He's been on the taxi squad. Milan Lucic has played, I believe, every game this season. So, and you know, he's fit a role. And when Milan Lucic was that last year in Edmonton, Scott, there's that famous quote where he says, I felt lost. Lost in life, lost in my role as a hockey player, lost on this team. And I could see the questions being from Calgary, well, if we're getting a player that's lost, like, what kind of player are we getting? Are we going to get that same player that he had in Edmonton, a career low in years? Or are we going to get a player that maybe thinks of this as a fresh situation? And I think when you look back on it now, I would absolutely say that Calgary won that deal, and they're getting a player that has been, you know, pretty... not pretty productive in the terms of putting the puck in the net, but he fits the role that they need him to be. Scotty, if the top two lines and that core group for the Calgary Flames were doing what we expected them to do, Milan Lucic would be the perfect complement player for them this season.
There are many who will look at Lucic and the way he plays and how hard he plays, Karen, and say, well, if everybody played as hard as that guy, this team would be in a much better spot for a team that has had its heart questioned collectively throughout the course of this season and seasons going back. And when you consider that Edmonton's still picking up part of the tab, it has been an interesting transition for Milan Lucic in terms of reputation. I imagine Flames fans were a little aggrieved when he comes in. There were those first couple of meetings with the Oilers in his first season where things are going down with Zach Cassian, Matt Tkachuk, and Lucic wasn't terribly involved, and people went, well, hold on, why did we get this guy? Isn't this why he's here? And now it's not gone a full 180, but people are much more on board with Milan Lucic in Calgary than they were at the get-go. And in Vancouver, which we'll get to in a second, I know you want to get a comment here that's coming into the inbox. In Vancouver, it's kind of gone the other way because he's a hometown kid and because of the evolution of his career and what it meant to Canucks fans.
So this one comes in from Steve, the Leafs hater. Know your role, and Lucic does that, and that's why Calgary won the deal. But then this one comes in too, and I think Ray and Campbell River likes Milan Lucic. He just says he can stay away from the Canucks. And Scott, you and I were talking before the break, that probably goes back to the 2011 Cup Final. And what Milan Lucic wasn't the hit, he didn't deliver a hit, but he did knock Dan Hamhuis out of that Stanley Cup Final. Canucks fans could maybe be aggrieved in the fact that that happened, and maybe that's why they didn't win the cup. You'll never know. But I guess when it comes to Canucks fans, they're like, just keep him on the outside and, you know, not touching our players.
You have to go back because he's playing his 1,000th game tonight, and it's so unexpected if you know the history all the way back to junior. If you know the history all the way back to junior with Milan Lucic, and look, this text comes in. You can say as many nice things about Lucic you want. He's still a scumbag. We'll always be a scumbag. Like, that's from a Canucks fan who's not a fan of Milan Lucic. But there is still a lot of time in Vancouver for a player who, when he first walked onto the ice with the Vancouver Giants, Karen, and he was going for a tryout. We're not talking about a guy who came out of Bantam and was a pick even. He was trying out for the team. And I'm not sure if we're going to get Don Hay on the program or not. That's his junior coach, obviously coached in the NHL in a couple places, including Calgary. Don Hay, Scott Bonner and company looked at him and went, oh, that guy can't skate. Like, that guy can't play at this level of major junior hockey because he's not a good enough skater. And little by little, he worked, and he hit people, and he made an impact, and he hung around, and he hung around. And eventually, Milan Lucic played his way onto that roster. But people in junior still didn't know what Milan Lucic was going to be. Well, what is he? Is he just one of those guys who's a little bit bigger than people at the junior level, but he's not going to be able to skate well enough at the NHL level? He ends up getting drafted in his hometown, not by his hometown team, but in his hometown. He's the 50th overall selection in 2006. That went down at Rogers Arena, at the time GM Place. Now, the Canucks drafted 14th overall that year. Milan Lucic was not going 14th overall, and they did not have a second-round pick. So for those Canucks fans who say, I can't believe they missed him, they didn't really. No one had Milan Lucic graded as a first-round pick in that draft outside of Milan Lucic. And I can still remember Steve Ewan, who covers the Vancouver Giants to this day, does a fantastic job for the province, talking to Lucic before the draft and Lucic telling him, I should be a first-round pick. Like, I should be in that first round. And people looking at that article, looking at that quote, going, that's nice. I'm really glad you believe in yourself. We hope the best for you. But no. In fact, many scouts, Karen, many organizations had Milan Lucic as a third rounder, and when Boston grabbed him at 50, there were some draft grades that went back as Boston reached for a player here. They reached for a player at 50. Don't know if this guy's going to skate well enough to ever make it into the National Hockey League. And now look what he's become.
Yeah, he's got 1,000 games in his NHL career. And Scott, maybe it's one of those situations. He was the type of player at the right time that came into the NHL for the right type of player for the NHL at that time. Can we agree? I mean, the NHL has changed over the seasons. We now see it's very much a speed game. But when he came into the league, he was, like you said, maybe not the fleetest of foot, but he was a big body that was willing to go into the hard areas. He was willing to stand up for his teammates, willing to make the hits. Obviously, we know about his penalty minutes as well. But he was a guy that was going to come in to an NHL at the time where big bodies, that if you didn't have the skating ability of some of the players now, that was kind of okay, as long as you filled a certain role. And that's what Milan Lucic managed to do.
Wins the Memorial Cup, goes off to Boston to training camp, and the Giants thought he was coming back. Like, everybody thought he was coming back. And as Mike McKenna mentioned in the first hour of the program today, never played a game in the minors. Cracked the roster. The Giants were shocked. They thought he was going to be their leader in following up on the Memorial Cup season. And all of a sudden, they had a big hole that they couldn't exactly fill with anybody who was quite like Milan Lucic. Canucks fans thought it was a great story because Boston plays in the East, and this is a local kid made good. And then, as you mentioned, 2011 comes around. He's part of the Big Bad Bruins. They end up taking away a Stanley Cup, and he hoists the cup in his hometown. Came back in the offseason. There were couple of different incidents off the ice that Canucks fans took one way, Lucic had a different opinion on. All I'm saying is it's been a very turbulent relationship in both markets with where they stand with Milan Lucic. I would think by and large in Vancouver, and texters, 650, 650, correct me if I'm wrong, 960, 960, that inbox is churning right now. I would think most people have a step back. They look at him playing 1,000 games, and they have a greater appreciation for it, even if they're not as big Milan Lucic fans as they once were.
So texts are coming to 960, 960, the Calgary Flames fans, Scott, and they're saying, nice seeing Luch play game 1,000 up for the Flames. Always cheer for a player who wears his heart on his sleeve and gives you his best night in and night out. Yes, he makes mistakes, turns over the puck once in a while. Not the best skater, but when he's on the ice, everyone keeps their head up. I'd rather have a bunch of his types playing than some others. And this one, as a lifelong Bruins fan and love Luch as a Bruin, it's been a few hard years for him, but I really think his game sense is underrated. He offers a lot more than the casual observer would think. One of the few guys here in Calgary who has performed his role as expected this season. The big man still has a lot to offer, even if speed isn't one of those things, and that's from Robin Airdrie.
And keep those texts coming in.
Like, I think that's true. I think when you look at what Milan Lucic has done this season, and he's done exactly what you would have wanted for the Calgary Flames. It's not Milan Lucic the reason the Calgary Flames are where they are. It's the top six and that core, right? So you put Milan Lucic right now on a top six that is performing at the level it should be. He is the perfect third-line complementary player.
It's Rentoul. It's Sermon. Get your texts in, 960, 960, or 650, 650. Milan Lucic plays game number 1,000 in the National Hockey League tonight. It is certainly an unlikely story. Another guy who got to 1,000 games and just barely got to 1,000 games did play for the Vancouver Canucks. He played the majority of his career with the Vancouver Canucks, and there are a lot of people who wanted him to play his entire career with the Vancouver Canucks. But Ryan Kesler finished with the Anaheim Ducks, and he barely got across that 1,000-game line, and he's spoken about the importance of it as well. Ryan Kesler, with all that went down with Taylor Hall yesterday and using his no-movement clause to his advantage and steering that trade to Boston, Ryan Kessler's a guy who certainly steered his direction in Vancouver when he was ultimately moved. Everybody thought they knew the story. Ryan Kesler shed a little more light on it. We'll react to it out of hearing Kesler yesterday on the afternoon show, the People Show in Vancouver on 650, had this to say about the way he handled that no movement clause when ultimately he was dealt to Anaheim.
You know, with my situation, I'll tell you guys the story. I gave Vancouver six or seven teams. When they came to me and asked me for teams, I talked to my agent. It was like Tampa, Pittsburgh, Colorado, Detroit was in there, Chicago, Anaheim, and maybe the Rangers. And I didn't get traded at the deadline. And then summer comes and Jim Benning comes in, and I really sat down and really thought, and I'm like, you know what? I just gave them half a team and they couldn't deal me when I asked to be dealt. And, you know, I heard Pittsburgh had a deal for me and it fell through. Don't know why, still to this day, but they go on and win the cup. So then summer comes, Jim Benning gets hired, and Jim calls me and he's like, okay, we have your seven teams. we're going to get the work here. I said, Jim, it's not your fault, but it's two teams now. And he got all mad with me. And I was like, Jim, I asked to get dealt last year. You put me in a really bad spot the rest of the year. Everybody knew I wanted out. My teammates, everyone, I had to play. I know it's not your fault, but these are the cards that are dealt now. And this is the two teams I want to play for, with Chicago and Anaheim. And I said, I'd appreciate it if you got it done. And he did. He was good about it. And he's like, okay, I understand.
That's a pretty good story.
It is.
Ryan Kessler saying, you know what? It's not your fault, but that's down to two. I know it used to be six or seven. That price tag has expired, or that offer has expired. Here's the new offer I have for you. Send me to Chicago or send me to Anaheim if you are getting me out of town.
And good luck getting anything good in return when you have your hands cuffed like that. Of course, Jim Benning, the first thing he has to do is try and fix this. Ryan Kessler wants out. He wants out for two teams. And, you know, he gets Lucas Pisa, Nick Bonino, and what was Jared McCann at the time, Scotty. But it's funny because, I mean, Kessler's like, you know what, there's nothing against you, Jim, but, you know, now it's down to two teams. And I think there probably was a little bit of sour grapes from Ryan Kessler. I mean, because of the fact he wasn't traded to Pittsburgh, who ends up going on winning the cup. Of course, that's what Kessler's doing. He's trying to chase a cup here. And so, I mean, a bit of sour grapes. But it just shows, Scott, what happens when you give players these no-move clause and you give them to them so they can take hometown discount and stay in your city and have security down the road. And in the end, Ryan Kessler used it to his advantage. And that's exactly what Taylor Hall is doing. He's using it to his advantage.
Okay. I've got a couple of thoughts coming out of this. One, as much as Ryan Kessler was booed upon returning to Vancouver, playing with the Anaheim Ducks, given the fact that he asked out and got traded out, imagine what it would have been like if he went to the Chicago Blackhawks and came back to Rogers Arena. Can you imagine what that scene would have been like?
Thousand times worse. It's probably better that he went to Anaheim for his sake.
It probably is better that he went to Anaheim for his sake. Here's the other part. I have long said this. Considering that there were two teams Jim Benning was going to deal with. Look, Chicago or Anaheim, or I'm not okaying the move. So Benning can do one of two things. I guess one of three things. He can trade him to Chicago, sworn mortal enemy of Canucks fans. Mm-hmm. He can trade him to Anaheim. Same conference, same division, tough team, still not a great look. Or he can say, nope, you're staying in the locker room. I'm not giving in to your demands. You're under contract to play here, which you run the risk of things going very poorly, training camp onwards. So he decides to trade him out of town. When you consider all of those parameters, I actually don't think the return was very bad. Go look at Jim Benning's trades throughout the years. It might be among his top five trades ever. I'm not even kidding you, Karen. Okay, so listen. He gets back in return. Nick Bonino, who was miscast in Vancouver, but ended up being a very important part of back-to-back cup teams for the Pittsburgh Penguins.
Yep.
Nick Bonino's a good player. 23rd overall turned out to be Jared McCann. 24th overall turned out to be Jared McCann, who's turned into a good NHL player. Not a great NHL player, but he's a good NHL player. You know when next pick?
Who?
David Pastrnak. So that could have been the return. Now, they chose Jared McCann, who's played just under 350 games in the NHL, which is still a decent pick. But they could have taken David Pastrnak. The trade itself, not that bad.
Funny enough, Jared McCann playing for a Pittsburgh Penguins team that Ryan Kessler would have liked to play for. Scott, I don't know if that says something about, you know, the trade history for Jim Benning more than it does about this trade itself. Maybe you could read in more to that. I know I liked Nick Bonino at the time, and like you said, miscast here in Vancouver, did very well. Very, very well. Third line with the Pittsburgh Penguins. Went to Nashville as well, and I believe had a pretty good, solid career there as well. It's just funny, because when I think of Ryan Kessler, Scott, he's kind of on this little bit of the reclamation project when it comes to, you know, how he's trying to get how he's viewed here, the Vancouver Canucks. We all saw it last year. I know this seems that this was maybe 5 years ago, but the Sedins had their numbers retired in Vancouver last year, and he came and he apologized for how he handled things in Vancouver, and now he's saying, you know, it's not on Jim Benning. I was the one that basically handcuffed him. I only gave him two teams when the team wouldn't trade me. So it's funny to see how Kessler's gone from being public enemy number one to being trying to get re-liked in the Vancouver market.
there's a lot more time for him in the market than there used to be. Someone says Kessler needs a history lesson when he is being traded to Pittsburgh. That's not the year they went on to be champs. Texter is right about that because that was the 2014 season. LA Kings end up winning it. Pittsburgh goes on to back-to-back cups after that. So maybe he was talking about that Pittsburgh would go on. He had his years a little out of sync there. Wasn't the point of the story, but...
The point of the story is when you give a player a no-move clause, you're giving them all the power in a way. And that's exactly what Taylor Hall had. When Kevin Adams gave him that one-year contract and gave him the no-move clause, there was always the chance, Scotty, that Buffalo was still going to be terrible. The hope was that they'd maybe be middling around a playoff spot, but the possibility was still there that he was going to be a trade bait at trade deadline. And when you give a player that no move, you have to deal with the consequences. The Canucks stay with Ryan Kessler.
Here's a question that comes in. Who would win a game between 5 Johnny Gaudreaus or 5 Milan Lucic's? 6-on-6 if you want to use them as the goalies as well. Karen, who wins? Team Gaudreau or Team Lucic?
I'm going with Team Lucic. Now, they might have a hard time trying to catch all the Gaudreaus out there.
They're never touching the puck. Like, they're never touching the puck, so that's part.
But if you
might
could,
depend on
if
who's
you could
refereeing.
Get him in a corner. If you could get him in the corner.
If. Like, who's refereeing the game? This might have everything to do with it.
Are you going to call the stick checks?
If you're allowed to do anything? Well, if you're allowed to do anything you want, then Team Gaudreau doesn't survive past the first couple of shifts. But I'm not sure Team Lucic is ever touching the puck. Interesting question posed by our listeners. I didn't get a chance to ask you about the Masters, so we're going to have to do that a little bit later on in the show. We had lots of texts coming in on the subject of Milan Lucic and Ryan Kessler. And we will head to Boston next. People are saying, what are you doing heading to Boston? That Eastern Conference, that East Division, I should say, man, it got better yesterday. It got better on a number of fronts. We will check in with Matt Porter on what is Taylor Hall debut day in Boston, and we will get his read on what is going on in that division as the arms race continues in the East. That is next with Rintoul and Sermon.
And Sermon.
For half of our listenership, our Make Your Case segment must have just been grating. I'm Scott Rintoul. She's Karen Sermon. It's Rintoul and Sermon. Thanks for joining us here today. Matt Porter of the Boston Globe will join us next. Want to check in on that East Division. Taylor Hall debuts for the Bruins tonight. Washington went out and got Anthony Mantha. The Islanders with Kyle Palmieri and some other depth moves along the way. And the Pittsburgh Penguins bring Jeff Carter to town as those four teams try to load up for what should be a great playoff battle. But you and I were making the case for a GM who had the best week. And we will ask our listeners to do that as well. Coming out of the trade deadline, now that the smoke has cleared, and some people weighed in for sellers. We had some say, hey, it's got to be Steve Yzerman with loading up all the picks or Jarmo Kekalainen. But you and I went with buyers, the people who had to be aggressive. You said Kyle Dubas had the best trade deadline. I said Don Sweeney had the best trade deadline. I'm not sure we could have picked two organizations that would have been more salt in the wound for listeners on the West Coast than the Leafs and the Bruins.
Yeah, you know, but when you look at what they did, I mean, like you said, Kyle Dubas, maybe the only issue that you could have with it is he bought pretty high in trying to get Nick Foligno out of Columbus. But when you look at the Boston Bruins, Scott, I mean, the fact that, it's completely shocking in the moment when it happened that they got Taylor Hall for a second round pick. I mean, to think about that, that is completely just... It boggled my mind when it happened. You thought, what is going on? How does Kevin Adams, he's getting swindled by Don Sweeney. And in the end, we find out that maybe Don Sweeney's hands were tied and this is the best he was going to, sorry, not Don Sweeney, Kevin Adams' hands were tied. And Don Sweeney says, this is the best package you're going to get. We're going to give it to you. Your player, he wants to come to us. This is all you're going to get. And Don Sweeney takes a flyer on a second round pick on a guy that right now they need, if he can regain his scoring touch, get more than those two goals, you know, find the back of the net, then this is a low-risk deal for Don Sweeney.
It's pretty wild to think that as poorly as things have gone in Buffalo, that Taylor Hall still only has two goals. That is wild to think.
Like, when I was looking at this, Scott, like, just looking at what Curtis Lazar brings. Like, he's got 5 goals on this season. The fact that Curtis Lazar, guy being played that was kind of thrown in on this deal, has 5 goals and Taylor Hall has 2. It's a shocking season by any stretch of the imagination. I know Jack Eichel's been out, but with the expectation, Scott, when he went there, he was going to fill the net up. He's going to get a big contract after this season, maybe longer-term contract, and it has been anything but for Taylor Hall.
We'll get the view on that division, on what's happening with the Bruins, and perhaps on Milan Lucic as well. He's a made man in Boston. He'll always be able to go back there and be beloved. Probably won't ever have to pay for a meal or a drink in that town. We have the text continuing to roll in as Lucic gets set to play game number 1,000 tonight. Lifelong Canuck fan living in Calgary, says this text. Love, hate, mm-hmm. What a player, but wow. Dream career to win championships and get drafted in his hometown. And then join together with Cam Neely and hoist the cup in Vancouver. As a Canucks fan, that was very hard to take, says this texter.
This one coming from Colin in Calgary. When the Flames made the trade for Luch, I thought it was just what the team needed, and I got laughed out of the building when I said he can still chip in with 10 to 12 goals. He has been the only player to bring it every night other than Tanev. Again, that's Colin in Calgary. I think Milan Lucic, when you just see how much underperforming Scott and how fallen out of favor the top players in this fan base have become for the Calgary Flames, I think Milan Lucic doing what he needs to do and bringing it every night, I think the Canucks fans would just like to see that from every other player in the lineup.
Muffin Man countering with this. Hey, Karen and Scott, 41 games, 16 points, and a minus 10. Hey, pump the brakes on Lucic a bit, says Muffin Man. If he looks good on your team, you're probably fifth, probably a sixth place team. That last part is fair as well. The only point, and I think most fans would echo this, is that based on what you expected from Milan Lucic, he's over-delivered. He's over-delivered this year. The raw numbers there aren't going to do what he is supposed to bring to your lineup justice. And as we said before, we're not talking about a player who's been flawless. I can go back and find you highlights of Lucic turning the puck over in the middle of his ice in the own zone and it leading to goals for the opposition this year. That's happened on more than one occasion. But there's been more good than bad. Let's put it that way.
And I think, too, when you look at a team where at some points right now, if you could just the hard working has been lacking at times, Scott, from some players on this team, I think that's what we're just saying. If other players on this team could be as hardworking as Milan Lucic is, night in and night out, yeah, you can live with the flaws right now because he is one of the only players on this team that's playing up to basically what his potential is.
Milan Lucic used to ply his trade in Boston. Matt Porter does that now with the Boston Globe, and he joins us now on Rintoul and Sermon. Matt, thank you very much for doing this today. How are you?
I'm doing great. I work just as hard as Milan Lucic, and the expectations for me are just about where they are for Lucic.
Are the checks the same?
No. He would put me through the glass like he did Mike Van Ryan one time against Toronto.
I was actually talking about the paychecks, but that's fair as well.
Oh, yeah. Those are though. Yeah, those are similar for sure.
Very similar, Matt. It is Taylor Hall debut day in Boston. What is that market expecting from the deadline acquisition?
Well, I think casual fans, and there are, there like every market, down here south of the border, there's casual fans. There's fans that kind of jump in and jump out, and I think those fans will say, this guy was the number one overall pick. He won an MVP. I mean, bring us the cup. And I think, that's obviously not the Taylor Hall of 2021. And I found it really interesting that, you don't often hear athletes at this level say stuff like this. But, in his press conference yesterday on Zoom, he was saying, I'm not that guy anymore, essentially. He's saying, I don't want to be the face of the franchise anymore. And that's not something I'm comfortable with. It's a role that's, been put on me throughout my career. But, that's not me right now. I just want to be kind of part of the team. And he seems very comfortable filling a secondary role. And I think that's going to benefit the Bruins a lot. If he can kind of come in and solidify them in the middle, on the second line, on the second unit power play, where he was lined up today, playing with David Krejci at 5-on-5. I think that, he can do really well. Is he going to be superstar Taylor Hall? Absolutely not. I don't think so. But I think as long as the expectations are set there, I think he can certainly exceed them.
Matt, what was the reaction to what Don Sweeney had to give up just to get Taylor Hall? Because it wasn't a whole heck of a lot if you're thinking maybe 3 to a month ago, you probably would have thought he would have got a first-round pick.
Yeah, and from what's been reported, obviously Buffalo had better offers But Hall really steered this, and he, you know, as every player has the right to do that has a no-move clause, he used that no-move clause to say, this is where I want to go, and this is where I'm comfortable. This is the right situation for me, and good for him. And, you know, obviously that gave the Bruins a little bit of a discount. Anders Bjork is a hardworking player that the Bruins have tried to – they've given him plenty of run in the top six. Really wasn't a fit there. He's just a guy that, you know, I don't think – I'm trying to be as fair as possible to him, but, you know, he's certainly – you know, has plenty of speed, works hard, just doesn't really think the game at that level from what I've seen so far. Maybe with more reps in Buffalo, he'll grow into that role, but still a young player. And then a second round pick, not really very much in the way of, a return for Buffalo, but, you know, especially considering they had to give up Curtis Lazar, who is a player that, you know, the Bruins, I don't know if he's going to be protected. But, you know, he is a guy as a fourth liner who comes in with some grit and some edge, and you know, he can move around a little bit too on a very reasonable deal. So I think for Boston, it's an A+. I mean, I think there's no Bruins fan that's going to be disappointed with this return.
When you look at why Taylor Hall was brought in, obviously the fact is he's brought in to help score some goals. Why has goal scoring been such a difficulty for this Boston team this season?
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons, and as we've seen all across the league in this, you know, COVID season, stuff has snowballed, right? And just teams have gone completely sideways for a whole bunch of reasons. And the Bruins, you know, they started the year without David Pastrnak. He comes back. He's not really the same David Pastrnak as last year. Well, that's probably okay if everything else is going. But the Bruins had a whole bunch of injuries on defense. You know, they've used... tonight they'll put Mike Riley in the lineup, you know, who they got from Ottawa, and he'll be the 13th defenseman that they've dressed this year, which is, you know, even in this COVID year, that's up there at the top of the league. So that's been a big problem. They've really struggled to move the puck out of their zone. You know, teams like Washington, heavy teams like the Washington and the Islanders were really good at just getting the Bruins, you know, below their own circles and behind their own net and just hammering them and, you know, scoring goals that way. So the breakout, and that's been a real problem. You know, they've had some bad finishing luck. I don't think Taylor Hall of Buffalo is going to help them there, but the hope is that, you know, he can help them get out of their own zone with the way that he moves the puck in transition and the way he transports the puck and get them into some better situations in the offensive zone. It's and I should mention too, they're playing two rookie goalies right now in Jeremy Swayman and Dan Vladar, and that almost never happens, around Boston in the Tuukka Rask era. Rask being injured has been a big problem too, and Jaro Halak hasn't exactly played well, so it's quite a lot to digest.
In conversation with Matt Porter of the Boston Globe, talking NHL hockey with Rintoul and Sermon, the Bruins go out and make additions, but so does everybody currently entrenched in the playoff position in the East Division. Which team in the East, in your estimation, helped itself the most in the past few days?
Well, it's hard not to like Washington getting Anthony Mantha. You know, that's a move that I don't think a lot of us saw coming. You know, you figure, you know, it does make sense when you look at it in the sense that, you know, Mantha's, 26 now, I believe. You know, how much of a you know, how much of his prime is going to be left by the time Detroit is really ready to make a run at it. So get something for him now. Quite a haul that they got with the picks and, you know, the contracts and players coming back, to Detroit. Obviously, the Islanders getting Kyle Palmieri. You know, I think, you know, wherever he settles in, he's going to help them, whether it's with Matt Barzal or you know, on a line with Zajac and Pageau. Both of those guys, Palmieri and Pageau, have absolutely killed the Bruins this year. So nobody here was happy to hear about the Islanders getting Palmieri. But really, you know, Pittsburgh, very minor addition in getting Jeff Carter. You know, he can obviously help them, but how much does he have left? You know, that's kind of what you're looking at right now. It's definitely struggle to call it an arms race because I think a lot of these teams are solid, but I'm not quite sure, you know, if they're up to a Colorado or a Vegas in that level. But certainly it's going to be a dogfight in the East here for that Stanley Cup Stanley Cup semifinal spot.
Well, especially if Boston plays its way back with these games in hand into that mix that sees the top teams in the division separated by just 2 points right now. You mentioned the Islanders. They've killed the Bruins this year. Washington loaded up. They look ready to go under Peter Laviolette as well. Pittsburgh with Crosby, Malkin, we all know the history there. What is the juiciest playoff matchup in your mind for the Boston Bruins, assuming those are the four teams that get in?
Well, I was going to say Boston-Toronto. You know, if it gets past, well, if Boston makes it out, I mean, that would just be, can you imagine that as a Stanley Cup final? I mean, you know, if that's the way it breaks, it would just be incredible. But, you know, it's hard to ignore Washington. Those teams, you know, they played each other so hard, and you knew it would kind of go that way. There would be some emotion there with Chara, you know, switching sides, and, you know, Tom Wilson kind of running around. So obviously, you know, both teams get up for each other. But just the way it's played out, you know, you've seen T.J. Oshie, Lars Eller, Garnet Hathaway, you know, kind of all pick their rival Bruins that they don't like. You know, Marchand has been into every single game on fire. It's, you know, guys have gotten hurt. Guys have come back. Guys have had to answer, you know, the bell a few times, you know, dropping the gloves. It's been really exciting hockey, big, heavy hockey, and over seven games, you know, that would be quite a series. And I'm sure it's going to happen.
Matt, I wanted to ask you, because I know the Boston Bruins, some of their players have had some COVID situations and a bit of a pause earlier this season. Of course, in the Vancouver market, they're just coming back from a massive COVID situation within their organization. Have you talked to any players about how difficult it was dealing with COVID and how difficult maybe it was coming back from it?
Yeah, and I should say, too, best to everybody up there and certainly, you know, in and around the Canucks organization, but also in the market. You know, it's you know, we've had our scares down here in Massachusetts and, you know, obviously everywhere in the state. So as far as players go, you know, Curtis Lazar actually talked about it. You know, one of the newest Bruins, he talked about it from a Buffalo perspective because, you know, the Bruins weren't hit as hard as the Sabres or, you know, the Stars or certainly the Canucks, you know, have been. But Lazar talked about it as a snowball effect. You know, you get COVID. You know, rips through your locker room and then everybody's trying to come back and start losing games and, you know, the confidence falls off and it just kind of all snowballs on you. But it's tough. It's something that has to be taken extremely seriously. It's, you know, really affected a bunch of athletes here. And even in this market, we've seen, you know, one of the Red Sox best pitchers, you know, get COVID and struggle to come back from a heart condition that was related to it. You know, and this is a guy in the prime of his career. So it's definitely scary and, you know, something that I think everybody's aware of. And, you know, everybody's talking about how nobody's going out anymore. You know, nobody's doing anything, you know, but kind of going back home. And it's a grind and it's kind of a drag sometimes for them, but they're getting through it.
You remember how that market reacted to Tuukka Rask saying last year in the bubble, you know what, guys, I got to go home. I got to be with my family. It was a pretty polarizing event in the hockey fan base there. How much differently are things viewed a year later?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think that was really driven by, you know, and obviously nothing against sports radio. I love sports radio, but bad sports radio. You know, there's opinion havers and takesmiths, as I would call them, with, you know, that just kind of want to stir stuff up. And, you know, there's obviously a portion of the fan base that doesn't like Rask because they don't think he can be trusted. You know, they saw, you know, him give up two goals in 17 seconds in the 2013, you know, finals against Chicago. You know, whether it started from there or whether it's something else, there is an anti-Rask sentiment out there. You know, not unlike a Freddie Anderson in Toronto or, you know, wherever else you have a well-paid starting goalie that, you know, people aren't convinced he's the answer. But I think now, you know, there's just been so much out there now about how Rask, you know, his daughter had a condition, you know, had an incident, I should say, and he had to be there. And I think any of us, you know, who have kids would certainly, you know, it wouldn't even think twice. You know, it's just whatever you have to do, go do it. And, you know, the Bruins supported him fully. You never saw anything come out about it afterwards, you know, where, you know, there was some anonymous source or whatever saying, you know, well, Rask, you know, we don't, you know, a lot of people were really upset about that. I mean, no, I mean, this was a team that had a chance with a healthy Tuukka Rask to, you know, to win the Stanley Cup. And yet he couldn't go. And, you know, he was still welcomed back with open arms. You know, if people, I will say, if people do in that organization do have any anti-RAS sentiment, it has not come out, and I've heard nothing about it, and I don't think I'm alone in that regard.
As you well know, Milan Lucic, who started his career in Boston, won a cup there, plays game number 1,000 tonight. How is he regarded in that fan base to this day?
Oh, geez. Like a folk hero, you know, like a Paul Bunyan-type folk hero. You know, whether it's, you know, dropping the gloves with anybody, being one of the most feared power forwards in the game, you know, really for, you know, at his peak in Boston, you know, a very unique player, drawing the Cam Neely comparisons, and, you know, will obviously winning the championship, you know, just cemented that legacy, you know, taking him from, you know, a guy that players remember fondly, you know, to a guy that is an absolute legend in this town. I don't think the Bruins were, or Bruins fans, I should say, were dissatisfied to let him go when they did. I think it's kind of a case of a player leaving town on a high note. You know, he hadn't had exactly he was kind of trending downward a little bit. I think they cut ties with him at the right time, but it's all love here in Boston for sure. He'll always be a part of that 2011 team, and that's a group around here that doesn't have to buy too many drinks.
Matt, I just want to switch gears quickly on you from one folk hero to another. Of course, the big news coming out of Boston yesterday, a couple of big news stories, the fact that Julian Edelman is retiring from the New England Patriots. I don't think this is a situation where he's going to join, you know, Tom Brady down in Tampa Bay. But when you look at the career of Julian, you never know, I suppose. If Gronk can do it, anybody can. But when you look at what the career of Julian Edelman has been, where he started, where he got to, what comes to mind of just the overall body of work?
Yeah, I think he's a guy who's really hard not to root for, right? He's you know, the undersized guy that you know, gutted through his professional career. Obviously plenty of skill, you know, plenty of physical talent there, but you know, smart guy, more than pulled his weight on those championship teams when you think about what he did in the postseason. And that's, you know, I'm not in the Edelman to the Hall of Fame camp, but if he does have a case, it's because of what he did in the postseason. And always struck me as a guy who understood how to have a good time while obviously working in Foxborough under a guy like Bill Belichick, who, you know, I would say he's Edelman and, you know, Wes Welker, and some of the other Patriots, you know, really provided a nice counterbalance to, you know, the dour presence that was and is Bill Belichick. So I was always a big Edelman fan. I'm definitely wish him well. He definitely gave it all out there.
Is Belichick not excitable? Is that something?
Yeah, it's just a party animal, yeah.
Hey, Matt, great stuff, man. I appreciate it. Enjoy the Taylor Hall debut tonight, and I know we'll be doing this again as we make our way into the postseason.
All right, folks, good luck. Stay safe.
You as well. That is
Thanks, Matt
Porter of the Boston Globe. A little football talk there at the end. He's absolutely right. Julian Edelman is not a Hall of Famer.
No.
He'll get the Patriots bump from some. He'll get the championship bump from some. He does have one of the greatest catches in the history of the Super Bowl, if not NFL history, when they were on their comeback against the Atlanta Falcons. And he makes the catch over the middle where, unlike David Tyree, who probably has the greatest catch in Super Bowl history and pinned it against his helmet, like, that ball popped out of Edelman's grasp, and then he managed to get his hands on it just before it went on the turf. It's such a great shot when they were on their way back in that game. I know we don't have a lot of Patriots fans out there in the listenership. He's not a Hall of Famer, but he was a very important part of those teams.
It's funny, Scott. I was on Twitter yesterday when he announced his retirement, and a lot of, like, you know, NFL insiders or former players are like, let's just talk about Julian Edelman and what he did. Please don't let me have the conversation about, is he a Hall of Famer? Because I don't want to say anything negative about him. Can we just enjoy what his career was versus, you know, is he or isn't he? Matt brought up Wes Welker there. You know, there are two guys, and Wes Welker probably created the role that Julian Edelman filled, but smaller players, Scott, you can appreciate this, smaller wide receivers that are willing to go over the middle, get a lot of yak yards, take the big hit if need be, but that's, he filled a perfect role that Bill Belichick started with Wes Welker, moved on and got Julian Edelman, and I think, like you said, he's a folk hero there, and I think you just can appreciate where he started and where he got to in the end.
Yeah, and to be fair, it's the Patriots that created that role, and they put Wes Welker
exactly.
into it. They saw him in Miami, brought him in. When Wes Welker was a nobody. He really was.
Yeah.
With the Miami Dolphins, he was okay. They targeted him 100 times, and he had 67 catches, 687 yards. Like, he was okay. And Tom Brady, Bill Belichick, Josh McDaniel, they went out and they went, if we get that guy here, here's how we can change our offense. And truth be told, Wes Welker was a better player overall than Julian Edelman. But Julian Edelman was on more championship teams. Julian Edelman, I'd say Wes Welker on steroids, but that actually might be the case because Julian Edelman was busted for steroids at one point during his career.
Yeah, and he played through a lot, Scott. Of course, he only played, I believe, 6 seasons for the Patriots last year. Played through a ton of injuries over his career. And like you said, with the Bill Belichick creating that position, Scott, I mean, numerous other teams tried to go out and recreate it, and they just couldn't do it. I mean, there was some success with some certain teams. You could think about Cole Beasley when he came up with the Dallas Cowboys. Of course, he's doing the same thing now with the Buffalo Bills. But it was one of those things where Bill Belichick started something, and other people tried to recreate it. And basically, he's the only one that could do it well.
Danny Amendola, like, go down mm-hmm. the list, and as a small, not particularly fast white receiver, I've got all the time in the world for it. I've got all the time in the world for it, Karen. You know
you
I appreciate it as much as anybody out there. It's Rintoul, it's Sermon, making our way into the final hour, one that includes what should be a fun version of Notes and Quotes. You'll find out why in the final hour of the program.
Now back to Rintoul and Sermon.
I did think it aloud. Well, I didn't think it aloud. I thought it at the time when Matt Porter said it. One of our guests who's joined us so far on the program today, it's Rintoul and Sermon. Thanks for joining us. You can always get in on the conversation, 960, 960, or 650, 650. I asked Matt, what would be the juiciest storyline for a Bruins playoff matchup? And he said, well, I don't know, Boston-Toronto? Would it get any juicier than that? He's right, and it wouldn't happen until either the Final Four or the Stanley Cup Final. It would have to be there because of the divisional format this year. But it did make me wonder aloud, like, what's the one matchup that could cause you not to watch the Stanley Cup Final? And I
Boston-Toronto.
Like, if I threw that one out there, there'd be a bunch of people went, you know what, I'll find something better to do. Maybe not in Calgary, but in Vancouver, for sure there would be people who said, I refuse to watch it. I can't be happy about any of it. I'm out.
See, but here's the thing, Scott. What you want to watch is the fact that Toronto's going to get a 3-1 lead. They're going to be on the verge of the Stanley Cup Final. Finally, for the first time in, what is it, 50 years, 60 years? I don't even know what it is right now. It's been so long. They're going to bring it home. And then Boston comes back, Scott. We're going to have another. Comes back from 3-1 deficit in the series, in Game 7, winning in overtime. That is why you would want to watch this, because you know exactly that's how it would go for the Toronto Maple Leafs. They would blow a lead, Boston would come back, and they'd blow it again. And that's exactly why I would want to watch that series. And yes, I wouldn't have a problem with Boston getting another Stanley Cup because of that.
Well, that's my whole point. It's like asking people, and look, I don't have as much detest for the Leafs or the Bruins as many do on the West Coast. Like, I didn't grow up in Vancouver, so the Toronto hate that is part of growing up on the West Coast, like, I understand it, but it's just not ingrained in me. I didn't grow up here.
Yeah, I don't have it either.
I get it, but I just don't have that, Karen. But when you're asking people to choose between two bad options in their minds, like, they just don't want any part of it.
It's the lesser of two evils doesn't come into effect when it comes to this
one? No, I think people would just say, we'll just pretend that there's a Stanley Cup that didn't exist this year. I'm Scott Rintoul. She is Karen Sermon. We teased it long enough, and we've waited long enough, but there's been so much hockey to get into. And even with the Jamal Murray injury and Steph Curry last night, we chatted about that a little earlier in the program today. The Masters. We went into the weekend talking about a stacked up leaderboard, some pretty big names, and it ended up being pretty anticlimactic, and it was all undone in a matter of seconds.
Yeah, there was a coffee cup there, Scott, where you thought that maybe Xander Schauffele could make it something. We're like, okay, finally, Hideki Matsuyama's not going to run away with this. We may have some drama coming into the final three holes, Scott. And just like that, the splash of a golf ball into the pond at 16, and it was all undone. And once again, it was a kind of anticlimactic, no drama when it comes to the Masters. I will say this, though. I am going to give so much props to Hideki Matsuyama. If you watched his round on Saturday, he was basically flawless. He was. It was the only bogey-free round of the tournament. He, the shot that he hit, Scott, on 18, in his approach shot, he hit it over the green. It rolled into basically where the people were sitting, the patrons were sitting behind the green. I thought to myself, when he has this chip shot, he has nothing to work with to try and get the ball close to the pin. Cool as a cucumber, steps back in there, hits an approach shot within a couple of feet, again saves par. I mean, that third round was one of the best rounds of golf that I've seen played at that Masters. It was just so impressive. Not at that Masters, at the Masters, it was so impressive. And then to come down on Friday, you know, again, pretty anticlimactic towards the end, but pretty really seems like a really good guy and really like guy on the tour to win. Good story, just not, you know, the drama that we had hoped for.
I wasn't cheering for Xander Schauffele against Matsuyama. It wasn't anything to do with that, but they have the two-shot swing on 15. It looks like the tournament's out of reach. Schauffele birdies, Matsuyama bogeys. You've got two shots, three holes to go, and you went, okay, the guy's going to have to go out and win it. And because Schauffele puts it in the drink on 16, that's what we were robbed of. And it has nothing to do with how well Matsuyama played the tournament overall. And I will not take anything away from that round you talked about on Saturday. It was an incredible round. But what do we want at these majors? We want someone to have to finish at the end. And we got deprived of that because of one tee shot that Schauffele still thinks he hit really well. It came up a little bit flat, or fat, I should say. It ends up going into the water. And all of a sudden it was, well, I guess I can turn the tube off now. Like, there's no pressure here for Matsuyama.
No.
He's going to win this, and good for him. And it's very akin, him winning in Japan, to how well it went over. In fact, you can make the argument it was much bigger in Japan and will be much bigger in Japan than Mike Weir winning the Masters in Canada. We know what that felt like for Canadian golf. With how much that country's sporting nation loves the sport to begin with, this is massive. And I don't know if you saw some of the projections about what he's going to make as a result of endorsements out of this. Like, it's wild. It's wild. This is going to be hundreds of millions of dollars for him. Some people think that, you know, going down the road, if he continues to play, like, this might be a $1 billion win.
Wow. Well, when you think about it, Scott, Japanese culture, and they love their athletes. Like, you look at Kei Nishikori when it comes to men's tennis. He actually had to move to Florida because he couldn't live there anymore because he was too big of a star. And he just couldn't go out because he was mobbed all the time. You think of Naomi Osaka. Again, you want to talk about endorsement deals. After she won the U.S. Open, she is now the highest paid women's tennis player, probably women's athlete, I have to think, in the world right now because of the endorsements that she got and garnered by just winning that major championship. And again, hopefully the game of tennis grows because of that. Game of golf, we've already seen how big the game is over in Asia and especially in Japan. And to think, Scott, that Tsubasa Kajitani, many people may have not heard of that name. Just to think, a week before, a Japanese female wins the amateur as well. So, I mean, the game of golf is in good hands when it comes to Japan, but you can only think of how much more this is going to grow the sport over there. And to think, too, the Olympics are going to be held in Japan this summer. So not only are they going to have the Masters, they could have a possible Olympic champion. Can you imagine when he steps to that first tee? Hopefully there'll be fans there. Just, it's going to be incredible scene.
Yeah, there's not going to be many fans. We know that. Traveling parties, they've already said that's not going to go down.
They will all be Japanese fans, I believe, too, because I think they're only going to allow them from that country. So
yes,
it'll be pretty impressive.
And you heard them on the broadcast say, look, if he wins the Masters, the prediction on the broadcast was that he lights the Olympic flame. And maybe it will be Matsuyama. Maybe it'll be Naomi Osaka. It could be either. It could be both. Who knows? But that's the type of regard we're talking about. Text comes in. The Masters was all about Saturday this year. Yep. Moving day rarely disappoints. It's very true. And from a Canadian perspective and your betting perspective, which was a small wager, but one that looked like it had a chance to pay off. Man, Corey Connors on Saturday has the ace on six, goes low, gets himself into position where you thought maybe, just maybe, if things break his way, he might contend for the Masters on Sunday. Moving day was great.
Yeah, it absolutely was. Corey Connors, of course, basically two holes, I believe, were the downfall of him on Sunday. I didn't have a lot of expectation, Scott, that bet would pan out. I think it was a $5 bet at plus 5,000. So, you know, pretty good return if I could get the $250. But again, for Corey Connors, top 10 finish, which is huge. He top 10 finished last year when it comes to the Masters. So I have to think third time might be a charm when it comes to 2022. Talk about Jordan Spieth, though, Scott. I believe he finished T3rd. Again, had Sunday couldn't put a full round together. Maybe in the end, Matsuyama had too big of a lead going into the final round anyways, and it wouldn't have mattered what Jordan Spieth could do. But it was nice to see, again, him put it all together on back-to-back weeks. He won last week, the week before, showing well in a major. That's really good for the game of golf. But I have to say this. I mean, like, the guy who stole the spotlights was Will Zalatoris. I mean, we don't know if he's Happy Gilmore's caddy or if it's, you know, who he is out there. Did you see the comparisons?
Oh, yeah, I did. And I saw them talking about how he's got a 28-inch waist on the broadcast. And look, he is a very slight young man, but
yes,
star of the show. And there's one of those every once in a while in golf or every once in a while in tennis. And the good news for Canadian tennis is that it's been a guy in recent years like Denis Shapovalov, that kind of out of nowhere young, hey, could this be something type of golfer. Hopefully for Zalatoris as he goes on that there's more to come. But boy, was he nails down the stretch. And what a great finish for him despite not winning the event.
Yeah, absolutely. He gets up par on 18 to give, you know, maybe Hideki Matsuyama a little bit to think about when he comes to the tee at 18. What I like about Zalatoris is, Scott, is like he doesn't have actually a card or playing status on any tour, no playing status. He gets into the Masters, I believe, because how he finished at the U.S. Open. And he's got a top 10 now at the U.S. Open. He's got a top 10 now at the Masters. He's going to come back and play the Masters next year. So I'd like to see. The only thing I hope with Zalatoris is we keep seeing him play this consistent type of golf, because he's a little bit of flair out there, Scotty, from golfers that we don't usually see.
It's not the same because he didn't do it in the exact same manner. But do you remember when Sergio broke onto the scene as a youngster at the PGA, and he's running and leaping to see where his shot went? Like, there was that type of youthful exuberance to the Will Zalatoris story.
Yeah, absolutely. I can see the comparisons there. And now hopefully it doesn't take Zalatoris as long as it did for Sergio to capture his first major, especially when it comes to the green jacket. But it's, you know, it's an interesting time for golf because right now you don't have the Tiger Woods, but you have some of the big names that are still out there. I mean, John Rahm put him in a good round. Bryson, I'm glad to see that he did nothing out there at the Masters. It's nice to see because I know he was everybody's curiosity. It piqued everyone's curiosity. It still shows, though, Scott, that, you know, Bryson maybe isn't ready to be winning every tournament out there. But it is an interesting time for golf because they've got Jordan Spieth back. They can market him. We'll see what they do nationally with Hideki Matsuyama. But you got a lot of young guys coming up, too, that have a lot of intrigue that the PGA may be looking at and going, okay, this is somebody that we can market to the younger generation.
The best thing that could happen for golf is not trying to find another Tiger Woods. That's not coming. It's not. I don't know when people are going to get past that. I'm not suggesting that what Tiger has done can't be broken record-wise. Maybe somebody wins more than him at some point down there. It's going to be a long time, though. And what he did with the majors, like all of those things. But they're not getting another Tiger Woods dominate that same way. And that could be fine. They don't have to continue to look for that guy, Karen. Look at what happened in men's tennis. That is the best thing that could happen to golf, in my estimation, where you've got three or four guys that you know every single major, they're going to show up, they're going to be there on Sunday, and you're not quite sure which one's going to take it at the end. Federer started it, then comes along Nadal, Djokovic is there, Murray was the plus one to the party. If they could have some sort of feeling of that in golf, that is the best case scenario for the sport.
Yeah, it'll be curious to see, though, Scott, if they can find that, because golf is such a finicky game. I would suggest that maybe in golf you're trying to find your swing more often or change your swing or find the better technology is more than in tennis. So I think to have four golfers that are competing, you know, major in or tournament in, tournament out might be hard to find. What I would like to see with the PGA is finding those personalities and capitalizing on them. Like the Zalatoris kid seems like a very interesting personality. Max Homa, I don't know if you guys, if our listeners follow him on Twitter. He's an excellent follow on Twitter. He's got a personality. He's funny. He just won on the PGA Tour. Something like that. Like, find these guys that are individualistic and find a way to market them.
Now, he wins the event that Tiger presents him with the trophy at. And then the next week, because he doesn't have a black and red kit to go with on Sunday, people are crushing the guy because he couldn't get his sponsor shirt and pants there in time. And people are all over, like, man, settle down a little bit. But yeah, he's... He's one of the, look, that's an easy segue into hockey, isn't it? This is a conversation we've had about the National Hockey League for years. How do you capitalize on the personalities? And that's why the ESPN deal is as significant as anything that's happened in quite some time, because that network and those platforms have shown an ability in previous years to bring out those personalities, getting guys involved in those ESPN ads like Alexander Ovechkin, the Devil's mascot, little things like that. I know that's not a player in particular, but there are certain gateways for players opening up a little bit more. And hopefully for the National Hockey League, that will be one of them.
And it might be an instance, Scott, in the States, because hockey is not the number one. You know, it's not the NBA. It's not the NFL. Players maybe in the United States might feel a little bit more open because they're not as heavily scrutinized. And so they would be willing to do these commercials. I mean, I could see Claude Giroux doing a commercial with Gritty. For, you know, ESPN, I could absolutely see that. They're best friends, you know, or Kevin Hayes or something like that. I think in Canada, when it comes to, you know, trying to market like Connor McDavid or even Austin Matthews or Elias Pettersson or Matthew Tkachuk, it's just they're so much more reserved up here, Scott. So they don't want to say the wrong thing. They don't want to be scrutinized. The media circus is just so much more. I think that it just comes to, it's just harder to get those guys to open up up here.
It's not just up here, but it's the culture of the sport as much as anything. It's team before individual. It's one of the things that hockey fans love about the sport, Karen, but it permeates into the off-ice branding as well.
Yeah, in terms of...
If an individual comes out and makes it about himself in the media, there is a perception among hockey traditionalists that it is taking away from the team and that hockey is all about team. I think you and I are on the same page where we believe that the ultimate team sport is football, but hockey is very close to it. Like, hockey's not a sport where you can dominate with the best player. The Edmonton Oilers are living proof of this. Connor McDavid has been the most dangerous offensive weapon for quite some time, and Leon Draisaitl isn't very far behind. And yet that has not translated into success. It's one of the things that people love about this sport. It's part of the reason the Toronto Maple Leafs have gone about constructing their team this way this year. Got to bring
absolutely.
In role players. Got to bring in guys further down the line.
You just can't have those top-end scores because, in the end, those top-end scores may fizzle out, or you have go up against a team where they figure out how to shut them down. It's when it comes to personalities in hockey, it's just, I don't know if it can be changed, Scott, in the personality of the players. Like, if we brought into hockey culture that it's okay to say things that, not necessarily bad about your team, but it's okay to show your personality. Maybe Roberto Luongo might be the best case scenario, or you could use this as an example, Scott, when you're trying to teach younger kids maybe to show themselves individualistically a little more. Like, when you look at when he was here in Vancouver before the Strongbone Twitter account became a thing, he was very thought of as reserved, maybe a little standoffish, didn't like to deal with the media. But then when you saw him able to expand himself in that role, Scott, of being on Twitter, and you saw, wait, this guy's actually funny. He's likable, you know, maybe that's one of those tools that you can use. And maybe I just don't know. I don't know how you change the culture at the lower level to allow these kids to shine a little bit more in their personality. And maybe here's the thing, you know, in terms of social media, here's maybe a cautionary tale. I mean, Adam Gaudette, Scott in Vancouver, showed himself on Twitter, you know, was very active on social media. Sometimes that was a hindrance. Sometimes he got a little bit, you know, the fans didn't like that too much. Maybe he was too active on social media. So there's a little give or take when it comes to showing too much of your personality so that the fans can get to know you, invest in you, or showing too much and then they say, oh, you're not enough about the hockey.
It's Rintoul. It's Sermon. Text comes in. You're so right. Case in point, PK Subban. It's an interesting name to bring up. There are those around the game who have said, yeah, PK Subban's made it too much about himself, that he's rubbed teammates the wrong way. Haven't been in those rooms. Those whispers have been around for many years. He's certainly not the prominent player that he once was in this league, despite the fact he's making a pretty prominent paycheck still in New Jersey, Karen. But our listeners are jumping in on this, and so you should. 960, 960, 650, 650. I think there was a lot of pushback to that idea around Subban saying it's overblown. I can't tell you for sure because I haven't been in those dressing rooms. I've been more on that side of it than not. Like, just let guys express themselves. And
yeah,
like any office, you're going to have people that you want to hang out with more than others. It doesn't mean that they're a problem necessarily. And if they can help contribute to a winning product, that's really what matters in the end.
Yeah, I like what PK Subban has done. Like, when he was, you know, engaged to Lindsey Vonn, I mean, they were very in the public eye, and I actually quite liked it. I liked seeing personalities. I liked him, you know, going to the ESPYs and dressing up and showing just a little bit more of himself because of the fact that you just don't get to see that too often from hockey players. Again, you know, it's the same moniker maybe that Taylor Hall had in Edmonton. Like, he's a bad locker room guy, and again, you could point to many reasons why Taylor Hall was like that. PK Subban, maybe he made it too much about himself. I don't know. I mean, in Montreal, he's a pretty good hockey player. So whether, I don't think it's his personality that's, you know, maybe had the downfall of him. I don't think so.
I don't think that's an easy segue into Patrick Laine, but I did want to talk about him for just a minute. Boy, Karen, the two goals he scored last night, sensational. One was a blast from just inside the blue line. The other was an end-to-end, coast-to-coast job. When the mood strikes him right, when he's having one of those nights, he does things that make you think, okay, this guy can be a 50-goal guy at some point in time. If they can get the right centerman around him, not easy to do, but if they can find a way to do that in Columbus, if he gets the right coach in there, if I don't know about temperament or not, but if he's motivated on an every-game basis, like, the talent is there. You understand why everybody has been so tantalized by what Patrick Laine can do. And we had a text earlier come in saying, you wonder if him having a night like that has to do with seeing the end of the road for Torts coming this summer.
Oh, absolutely. I think he looked and he said, okay, Nick Foligno's been moved out, Scott. Dave Savard's been moved out. We've talked about the fact that those are very much Torts guys. Maybe Patrick Laine goes, okay, I can take a deep breath. With these guys being moved out, John Tortorella's going to be the next guy moved out. If I choose to stay in Columbus, of course, he is an RFA. They do have his negotiating rights. But you know what? Maybe he took a deep breath and goes, oh, just going to play my game for the end of the season. Doesn't matter what happens to John Tortorella. Doesn't matter if he benches me. I'm going to try and play the way that I want to play. And we showed it last night. I mean, that was Mario-esque, that finish at the end. You know how Mary goes flying in the air and gets tripped over the goaltender? It was that special.
It was a great goal. I am interested to see how Torts handles things down the stretch from a media point of view. When the end came for John Tortorella in Vancouver, which was not long after the start, he lasted only a season, but there was this resignation, but almost relief. Like, John Tortorella came to Vancouver and repaired his image. Yeah, he went and tried to fight Bob Hartley, but nobody really begrudged him for that. But I'm talking in the media. Like, he treated the media quite well. There wasn't bombastic stuff that you saw with Larry Brooks and you've subsequently seen in Columbus. Media-wise, he repaired his image. But he got to a point when the writing was on the wall as to what the team was going to be, where he just started dropping truth bombs. And one of the things he's remembered for in Vancouver is saying, at some point, you guys got to get past 2011. Like, you got to stop talking about it, and you need to move on. And it's one of the things he did in Vancouver that a lot of people will remember. I'm interested to see how he exits Columbus if that's what ends up happening. I think that's the way it's going. I think it's been going that way for quite some time. You've heard him tease it to a certain degree along the way where he said, hey, we've built this into something different than it was before. And he's right. Columbus isn't looked at like a bit of a joke like it was before. Yeah, I know they've got a couple of decent players and they might make the playoffs, but they're not going anywhere. Nope, he built that into a team. He and Jarmo Kekalainen built that into a team that you had to take seriously and has actually won playoff rounds along the way.
Joe from East Van says, Sermon, you're out to lunch. Tortorella is an awesome coach and is Jarmo's guy. He ain't going nowhere. He's a Stanley Cup winner. Joe from East Van, are you being sarcastic in this? Because I think you are. I think the writing is on the wall when it comes to John Tortorella's time in that market. Scott, I mean, I think the writing's been on the wall for probably a month, if not even longer, with how Columbus has done this season. I mean, they've traded out his guys. I don't think he's Jarmo's guy at all. I think Jarmo Kekalainen has... Well, I think Jarmo Kekäläinen has seen he's gotten all he can do out of, get out of John Tortorella with this team. John Tortorella's time runs its course over for, with teams. It just does. You've seen it a bunch of times. You saw it in New York. You saw it in Tampa Bay. I think this is what's happening here. He's run his course. He got as much as he could out of this. Move on to somebody else.
Look, it's not just John Tortorella. Like, this happened with Peter Laviolette in a couple of different stops. It doesn't mean Tortorella can't coach. You want a closer to home comparison, Big Joe? Because I'm on Karen's side. I think this is going to end up being the end of Tortorella in Columbus. And I think it'll be a handshake with Jarmo Kekäläinen going, this has been a really good run. I got a ton of time for you, man. I think you're still a very good coach. We just need to go a little bit different direction. I think Torts might feel the same way about it when all is said and done. Do you remember when Alain Vigneault left Vancouver? Nobody thought for a second Alain Vigneault couldn't coach. Not for a second. And he was hired in a nanosecond. That was it. He was next. He was the coach of the Rangers, and that was it. But it felt like it had run its course, and they made a change. And it feels like that's what's going to happen to Columbus. They didn't have the same degree of success, but they built it to a point, and now they'll hopefully for them bring in somebody who can take it to a new point.
Yeah, and sometimes it's just the point, Scott. Your message is, you just realize as a general manager, the message from their head coach is just that not getting across to these players anymore. And it's one of the things where you just have to move on. You see this all the time. You could see it with the Ken Hitchcock. You could see it with a bunch of different coaches over history. And I think the time has come that John Tortorella will be done in Columbus.
Keep those texts coming in, 650, 650, or 960, 960. We will turn our attention ahead to the games that lie before us tonight. A six-pack of games on ice and some really interesting storylines, some quotes, some notes. You'll get them next with Rintoul and Sermon.
Now back to Rintoul and Sermon.
A couple of good suggestions. Text message inbox 960, 960, or 650, 650. It is a game day for a number of teams. Flames and Leafs, by the way, going at it tonight. You'll hear more about that in notes and quotes in just 1 second. A couple of texts came in. We were talking about social media, where it's at with players in the NHL, how comfortable they are. Someone sent in the name Biz Nasty. That is the best example of a player who would have been, quite frankly, a nobody in the National Hockey League, very unknown to most fan bases, if not for his social media presence. And that doesn't mean he was always on the right side of the line with it. Like, the reason it's Biz Nasty 2.0 is because he had to shut down the first account and tweeted some things back in the day, Karen, that should not have been tweeted, then started getting a little more social media advice, honed his craft. Doesn't mean he's everybody's cup of tea. I'm not suggesting that for a second, but he capitalized on social media, and his personality came out because of social media.
Exactly. And, you know, social media can be good, used for good and bad. I think we can both agree, Scott. We saw most recently Paul Pierce has been let go from his job at ESPN because of something he put out there on social media. So it's one of those things where players have to be, one, it could affect your job. Two, it could affect how players or fans see you, how your teammates see you. So I understand that there's a balancing act as well. And someone texted in, it's, you know, I think you can be yourself on social media and with the media if you live up to or exceed your contract or the fans' expectations. I mean, I think that's maybe has a little bit to do with it. That's from Brian in Nanaimo. But I think players right now have a hard time. One, if you have a social media account, you can face so much more criticism probably than positive feedback. And they're just afraid of doing something that could hurt their reputation or hurt their careers.
Yeah,
it's
so when you say
it's so, such
well,
a balancing act.
When you say be yourself, like to what extent?
And exactly.
That's the balancing act, because we live at a time where the line between actually offensive things and things that can be perceived as offensive is very thin. Mm-hmm. Very thin. And sometimes it's a matter of education, Karen, but that's not what I'm talking about. I think most people know what I'm talking about here. And so there are plenty of players, and this isn't just in the NHL. There are plenty of players who say it's not worth the aggravation. I'm not going to do it because I don't want to accidentally misstep.
I don't want to accidentally misstep, or two, Scott, like, it's not worth your time because you don't want to hear some of the feedback you get. I mean, we have sometimes, we have the text message inbox right in front of us. It's not always good things. I mean, someone just told me that I was out to lunch. You know, you have to have a thick skin. And when it comes to a player, is it worth their time to read these things about themselves? Probably not.
Someone says social media sucks because if someone doesn't say what you like or doesn't like what you say, I should read properly. They just get banned. No one has a sense of humor anymore. And again, depending on what we're talking about, that can go a bunch of different places because some quote-unquote humor is not that. And like I always say,
it doesn't translate well.
Well, what's the first rule of comedy? Be funny. And there are things that people put out there that aren't funny that they sort of thought were funny, and then they try to walk it back, and there's no way of getting out of it. It's Rintoul, it's Sermon. As mentioned, there are six games on ice tonight. Let's get into some of them, and we will begin with David Rittich, at least we think, facing his former team tonight. Eric Francis indicated that early. I think that's going to be the case. Who plays goal the rest of the way for the Calgary Flames? What happens there? Pretty funny exchange between Daryl Sutter and Danny Austin today. Have a listen.
With David Rittich gone, I mean, are you comfortable playing Jacob Markstrom in both games?
Sure.
Is your plan to play Jacob Markstrom in both games?
It's really none of your business. I don't know if he's starting tonight. So you usually announce your starting pitcher 3 days before. I don't know. Same with our goalie. I told you guys before, I don't tell you, you know, why would I pass through the media who's playing tonight and who's not, or who's, how he's feeling, or that's not information that's public knowledge.
And we can argue about whether it should be or not, but the reason would be because people are interested.
Yeah, there's
people
not much
care.
To be... I'm sorry, but when it comes down to the rest of the season for the Calgary Flames, this is what people are going to be interested in. What are you going to do? Are you going to see Jacob Markstrom out there? How many times is he going to play? Are you going to see anybody else in the organization? I mean, I love Daryl Sutter because we get to have these quotes, Scott. I just don't understand this whole notion of secrecy when it comes to who your starting goaltender is. NHL's, you know, the scouting departments for these teams are so good. It doesn't matter if you announce your starter 3 days in advance, 2 days in advance. Granted, he may not know who his starter is 3 days in advance. It may be a day-to-day thing, but I just don't understand why it's such a big taboo for some coaches to keep
it really
secret.
None of your business.
I don't know whether it's a day, a month, a year. In the very near future, I have no idea where it happens, Karen, but at some point this is going to be outdated. And Daryl Sutter is not alone. He's probably in the majority of coaches around the National Hockey League. Travis Green started giving the goaltender in Vancouver, but won't talk about other parts of his lineup.
That's it.
We are going to get into a place very quickly here in hockey where single-game betting has been approved in this country. When that happens and when more money comes in and when gambling is further incorporated into NHL broadcasts and into the mainstream, and you've seen a big advancement in that over the last 6 months even, but it's going to go further. And when we get there, there are going to be stricter regulations from the National Hockey League saying, guess what? We need better injury designations. We need an idea on these starting lineups because gamblers want to feel as though they have the pertinent information to make their wagers.
And we saw it a bit last year, Scott, with what the NHL has termed on what you can say this year about COVID versus what was said in the bubble. Last year, it was what was the term they used last year? Unfit to play?
Unfit
that
to play.
That was the term.
Unfit to participate. Yep.
Participate? Yeah. Who knows if it's a COVID situation? Who knows if it's an injury? And we did see this year that term unfit to play, thankfully never have to hear that again, was deemed unacceptable by the NHL. You had to be a little bit more transparent. I live for the days, Scott, where injury reports, where goalies, where starting lineups are transparent. Because like I said, these scouting reports with these teams, they are so advanced now and so prepared, it doesn't make a difference. It just doesn't. So it's going to happen at some point in time. I like this text that just came in. Scott, Sutter and Tortorella should have a podcast together. I think you'd listen. I'd probably listen too. Maybe not too many words would be said, but it'd be a lot of grouchy, angry conversations happening between the two.
Yeah, I would want to hear that. Someone else texting in, NHL coaches hate fun. Some of it's just like, I don't have to give this to you, so I'm not going to. Like, there are some that I think truly believe there's a strategic advantage if the other team knows what goalie it's going to be that night. And I think some of it is just, you know what, man? I got to answer a lot of questions, and this is one thing that I can still hold a little bit over you. So that's what I'm going to do.
It's funny that that's the hill that some of these coaches die on. It's just that's the thing that they choose.
David Rittich is slated to start against the Flames tonight based on the information that we've heard out there, the first of which came from Eric Francis this morning, who texted with David Rittich trying to get a comment from him, saying, hey, it's a game day. I'll talk to you on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. Milan Lucic, who plays game number 1,000 tonight for the Calgary Flames against the Leafs, had this to say about sharing a plane out to Toronto with his now-traded teammate, David Rittich.
Yeah, there were definitely some fun happening there as far as pokes and jabs. And, you know, obviously with the circumstances, you don't ever really experience something like that before, you know, flying with a ex-teammate or somebody on another team. But, it's kind of nice. It was kind of nice and cool to have him around for a little bit there and be able to properly say goodbye. And like I said, you wish him all the best after tonight's game.
There'll be a little more focus on the Flames' slim playoff hopes after tonight when they start taking on Montreal in their two-game mm-hmm. set that goes on Wednesday and Friday. The juice in this game, the Habs beat the Leafs last night, and the Leafs were awful at the start of that game. I believe through the first 25 minutes almost, they had only 5 shots on goal. They had a terrible start. They came back to tie it at 2, but Montreal eventually won that game 4-2. A big win for Montreal to snap a 3-game skid. And for Calgary, the motivation outside of potentially playoff hopes and getting things headed in the right direction after beating the Oilers on the weekend, beating your former teammate. There's a little personal rivalry involved here tonight.
Right. I mean, when you're Toronto, I mean, if you're Calgary, you're going to expect a better effort from the Toronto Maple Leafs on the other side tonight, because Sheldon Keefe came out and he took full blame for maybe just take the blame off the players' shoulders. But he did take blame for not having his team prepared to play that game last night. And, you know, Toronto, if it is going to be David Rittich, they're going to want to put a good performance in front of him, have a good showing for their new teammate, maybe try and limit the number of shots that he's going to see. So if I'm Calgary, I'm expecting a pretty good effort from Toronto tonight. In terms of Calgary, though, I mean, there is, yeah, the added motivation. You've seen this guy in practice. You know how to beat him. Let's try and continue this win streak as we try and push to the playoffs. So it's got a lot of storylines going into tonight. And it's funny, there's a bunch of different storylines, including one player who didn't get on an airplane, Scott, with his teammates and decided to drive instead.
So unless Taylor Hall just really wanted to have his whip in Boston with him, I have no idea why he wasn't on the plane with the Sabres yesterday. So he gets traded on Sunday, but it was pretty late when the deal eventually went down. He decided to drive this 7 or so hours between Buffalo and Boston. Why is he not on the flight with the Sabres? Why isn't he just taking that flight?
I mean, maybe he wanted some downtime, Scott, to listen to some music, chill out. I just got get in the right mindset to join Boston teammates. Maybe he wanted his car because we know everywhere is a little bit more accessible over on the East Coast. Maybe he just didn't want to fly with his teammates anymore. He's out of there. Okay, say goodbye to Buffalo. Maybe Buffalo said, nope, you get on a car, you drive yourself to Boston. There's a lot of different circumstances.
It's a pretty unique aspect of 3 of the 6 games on the schedule tonight. Like, yeah. Taylor Hall is going to make his Bruins debut against the team he was just traded from. You got David Rittich going against the Calgary Flames. At least that's what we think. Michael Raffel's going to play for the Capitals, or so we would think, tonight against the Philadelphia Flyers, having just been dealt there yesterday as well. As far as Hall goes, he's going to play on David Krejci's wing. Craig Smith is going to be on the other side. That's how they'll start this game. Their power play configuration, Taylor Hall was not on the top power play unit at practice this morning, but Mike Riley, who was recently acquired, will be taking the point duties on that, comes in with 19 assists, and a guy who can give them a little bit of offensive boost from the back end. Bruce Cassidy, the head coach of the Bruins. Sorry, Karen, before we get to that, Bruce Cassidy, his message to the newly acquired Taylor Hall.
I would think a guy that's scored his whole life, what'll get him going is producing offensively, right? That's what they're just used to. That's probably how they've been measured their whole life, right or wrong, and that becomes the story. So I've told him, hey, you're going to play with good players here, but help us win games. You know, that's how we're measuring you. We measure ourselves here with wins and losses. How do we do in the playoffs? Yes, he's an individual that will get judged by his point totals. But for us here, you know, if you play well and doing your job and helping us win, I think the points will just come just because he's done it everywhere. You know, this year, like I said, was an off year for him and the Sabres. They went through some COVID stuff early. Only he can talk to how that affected the group, the team, a change of coach, a change of GM, all those different things. You know, I don't know how it affects a player's psyche, Kevin, but for us, it's like, hey, you're in an organization that has expectations, a city that has expectations, and we want those. We want pressure on us, you know, and we want to embrace that because, you know, we've handled it well over here. So help us, you know, win games and by playing to your strengths. And that's kind of the message we give to Taylor. And hopefully that helps his confidence, A, winning, and B, you know, him making the plays he's used to making.
Scotty, don't you think that's a completely different mindset than Taylor Hall's ever had to have in his career? Because he has basically been, okay, you're going to bring in, you're the number one, you know, first overall pick with Edmonton, then going Jersey, you're going to help our team. But you got to help us by putting the puck in the net, because if the puck in the net goes in, that's how we're going to win hockey games. I think it's a completely different mindset change for Taylor Hall. Probably pretty refreshing one in that fact, too.
So we'll disagree, because Bruce okay. Cassidy can say that, and that can be the message. Taylor Hall is going to be judged on whether or not he scores there. People aren't going to look at whether or not Taylor Hall is making responsible defensive plays. That's not what he's going to be judged on. This is a former Hart Trophy winner going to a team that struggles to score goals. He's going to have to be involved in the scoring. He's going to have to be, Karen. That is what he does. That is what makes Taylor Hall the reputation. So we had people texting in earlier saying he's the most overrated player in the league. He stole the Hart Trophy from MacKinnon. And if he doesn't get that Hart Trophy, we'll look at him entirely differently. I agree with part of that text. Like, we look at Taylor Hall entirely differently if he doesn't win that Hart Trophy. It's attached to every single sentence that we utter about him. Former Hart Trophy winner. Like, gone are the days of former number one overall pick. The guy got the biggest individual prize you can get in this game. And because of that, everything he does now is measured against that.
And I just think, too, just it's the mindset. I understand at the end he's probably, you know, if he's going to end up having just two goals over his, what, 17 games that he's going to play with the Boston Bruins, probably going to be deemed a failure. But I do think that maybe for Taylor Hall, it's the mindset of, I'm just going to go out there and play hockey. Everything else will come. I'm not on that top line having to score, you know, get a goal night in and night out, whatever the case may be, putting up massive point totals. I think when it comes down to maybe just having Taylor Hall figure out how to get that scoring touch back, it comes down to just play hockey again. Just play hockey.
Yeah, and that may be fair. There's got to be a bottom line, though, with him. He doesn't have to be the leading scorer on the team. They've got the alpha dog in Brad Marchand, no matter what you think of him or not, and Pasternak and Bergeron and everything that he has come to symbolize to that team in that city. Like, Taylor Hall can blend into the background in that respect. I'll throw this one at you as well. Sight unseen. Hasn't played a game in that uniform yet. Taylor Hall plays next year for either the Bruins or the Field. What are you putting your money on today?
The Field.
I'm the other way. Taylor Hall plays for the Boston Bruins next year.
Okay. We're going to have to keep that one in the cookie jar there, Scott, for pull that one out. Because one of us will obviously take the loss. I do think that... I don't know if his performance level will be up to enough that Boston will be willing to give what Taylor Hall thinks he's worth. I think Taylor Hall needs to understand he's going to have to take a pay cut this summer. But I do think it's going to be interesting to see what teams think he's worth and what he thinks he's worth and where that kind of meet in the middle is. I'm going to go with the Field on this one.
The reason I think he plays there is because of everything you just mentioned. He's not cashing in on the open market this year. The only way he cashes in on the open market is if he starts scoring at a dominant pace. He is the main offensive driver on what is a lengthy playoff run for the Boston Bruins, and then he takes his wares to market. And what do you think the chances of that happening are? I think they're pretty slim.
I mean, they are slim, but I do think that, I mean, you know what? Maybe he has a good time in Boston and enjoys his time there. He thrives on a second line role, and he does. But I just think the odds are in the personally the odds are in the favor of the rest of the NHL. I'm going to go with the Field.
Okay, and you're smart. Hey, you're playing the odds. I'm saying he plays for the Boston Bruins next year. I think he's wanted to play there. I think as they look to turn that roster over a little bit, and some guys start to age out, They don't have a lot coming offensive-wise in the pipeline right now. They didn't have to give up much to get him, unless he's a total flop. I think he's a Boston Bruin next year. The man has made almost $53 million in career earnings on the ice so far. He doesn't have to hit the mother load on the open market. He can play for a little bit less in Boston, maybe get a little bit more security. I think he's going to like the sporting culture in that city. I think he's going to like the fact that he's not the face of it. I agree with that with you wholeheartedly. It's the reason I believe he stays there.
This text just coming in just because the listener didn't hear Scott. He's going to play on a line with David Krejci and Craig Smith. They did split up the perfection line, Pasternak, Bergeron, and Marchand earlier to try and get some scoring touch out there, but they've reunited the perfection line back together, and he's going to be on the second line with Craig Smith and David Krejci.
Steve says, if Boston wins the cup, Hall signs with the field. If they come close, but he doesn't, he signs in Boston. That according to Leaf Hater Steve. I don't think Boston's getting out of that division.
No, neither do I. I think they went out on Taylor Hall to take a flyer on a player that was having a bad season and has some scoring touch that we know we've seen over his career. If it works out, it works out. If it doesn't, it doesn't. But I don't see Boston getting anywhere past the likes of Washington or the Islanders.
Someone else saying Boston just wants the number one pick. Yeah, they have to fall out of the playoffs to get that, and that's a possibility if they do. But, man, now that would be something. If he wound up in Boston and that team also got a number one overall pick. Arizona obviously couldn't land it last year as they had their pick stripped away from them. I did see a great tweet about this the other day. I think it was Pete Blackburn who tweeted, 2010 me would have a really tough time dealing with the fact that the Bruins traded Tyler Seguin away for nothing and acquired Taylor Hall for nothing. When you think about that draft, hey, is it Taylor, is it Tyler? And the top two picks in the draft end up playing in Boston, and yet in the exchanges to get them there, not much comes back in either direction.
Yeah,
like Seguin got traded for very little.
He did, yes, he did, and they wanted to get him out of Boston for certain reasons, for sure. But it's kind of interesting, Scott, when you do look at the fact that, you know, Taylor and Tyler, Edmonton takes one, Boston takes the other, and now they both played in Boston. Come full circle.
One guy's got a cup, and he's been to the cup final very close last year, Tyler Seguin.
And the other guy gets you a first overall pick.
That's what it's been so far. Stars also in action tonight. They are right at that critical juncture. If they don't put something together here pretty soon, they're not getting into the playoffs. They are taking on Sam Bennett's new team. The Florida Panthers are in Dallas to play the Stars. Lightning and Predators tonight. Little surprised that Nashville didn't do anything really at the deadline.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying I expected them to be sellers because of the way they played themselves back into playoff contention here, Karen, but I thought they might do something in and around the edges. Lightning are cruising, hoping to get top spot in that division. The only other matchup on ice tonight, the Rangers and the Devils. Because Boston has games in hand and haven't gone great of late, the Bruins have played the Rangers back into the mix, but the Rangers also got to put something together if they're actually going to threaten.
Yeah, I think it's pretty much Boston's to wrap up. I mean, Scott, they've got two games on hand to the teams chasing them. Of course, that's Rangers and Philly. They don't play Philly anymore, but when you look at Boston's schedule, Scott, they've got 8 games against New Jersey and Buffalo combined, also 2 games against the Rangers. They've got a pretty, it's a tough schedule in terms of grind of games, Scott, but when it comes against their competition, I think Boston's pretty much in the driver's seat when it comes to getting that fourth spot. When it comes to Dallas, and we were talking about Tyler Seguin, did you see the reports? Like, they expect him back pretty soon, which is kind of a nice addition to their team. Who knows what health he's going to be at? Of course, he did have the hip surgery, so maybe it's just he gets a little flyer and tries to get his feet wet for next season. But, I mean, a guy of his talent, healthy, and that could be a very welcome addition to that Dallas roster.
We'll see what healthy means in Vancouver today. Canucks hoping to get more players back as they push towards Friday's return to action as far as games go. Edmonton Oilers, the first team up. Calgary plays tonight against Toronto, as we mentioned. That will be discussed further on the big show on the eastern side of the Rockies. We will send you there next. On the west side, it's Bick and the Boss. Karen and I are back tomorrow for a midweek edition. We will talk to you then. Big thanks to Jamie Dodd, producer of this program. And to Greg Ballack. Yeah, buddy, big ups back at Mission Control. Thank you very much for all of our listeners for chiming in. We'll talk tomorrow.